Hi, my name is Danielle, and you're listening to Crime and Mystery Canada. On this podcast, we discuss subjects that might be creepy to some, and sometimes even frightening. Some of our episodes will deal with serious subject matter, while others will be more lighthearted. Please keep in mind that I am not an expert on any of the topics I cover, just an interested party, and as always, listener discretion is advised. Hi everyone, I'm Danielle. And you're listening to Crime and Mystery Canada. On today's episode, we're going to discuss the 1989 massacre at L'École Polytechnique in Montreal. It's one of those cases that I knew about in the sense that I was aware that it was a mass shooting and that mainly women had died, but I didn't really know the details surrounding it. Once I started researching the case, I could almost forget that it was something that happened over 30 years ago, because unfortunately, it still sounds like something you'd read about in the paper today. Marc Lépine was not always known by that name. He was originally named Gamil Rodrigue Elias Garbi. He was born in Montreal in October 1964. His mother was French-Canadian and worked as a nurse. His father was an Algerian businessman, according to Wikipedia. Growing up, Marc was described as withdrawn, and he had difficulty connecting with his peers. When he turned 14, he officially had his name changed to Marc and took his mother's maiden name. His father, who was described as abusive, left the family when Marc was young, and Marc did not harbor any lost love for him.
I think that was one of the reasons why he took on his mother's maiden name, because he didn't want to acknowledge his father.
I think what he actually stated, I think you have to speak to a judge before you change your name, and what he said was that he hated his father and didn't want to have anything to do with him. His friends would say that Marc could be unpredictable and would fly into rages when he was feeling frustrated. Things didn't work out very well for Marc when he came into adulthood. He applied to the Canadian Forces but was rejected. He started a science program in college, but he dropped out. He was fired from his job working at the hospital for having a poor attitude. Apparently, this firing really enraged him, and following it, he spoke of going on a murder spree and then committing suicide. I'm assuming no one took what he said very seriously, but because it doesn't seem like anything was done following his comments.
I'm not sure how large his circle of friends was and if there was anybody actually paying attention.
That could have been part of the problem, because if there's not enough people or not the right people paying attention, things don't get done to try and fix the issue. It's one of those things, too. I don't think in 1989 that mass shootings were something that were very common. So if someone made that threat, it may have felt just like venting or kind of mouthing off about something.
Yeah, and I think in Canada, it was out of people's minds. It was not something that happened here. Mm-hmm. And if the military refused, I think he applied twice to the military. I believe he applied twice and was turned down both times, so they must have seen something in his psych reports that identified him as not a good potential candidate. So
yeah,
there were signs there, just not the right people to listen to them.
After he was fired, he then tried his hand at a computer programming course, but he dropped out of that as well. He ended up applying twice at L'École Polytechnique, but was rejected because he lacked the appropriate prerequisites. Now, this is a little strange to me because I can understand applying once and then being rejected and being told you need these courses to get in. I don't understand why you would apply the second time without actually having done the courses.
Well, I think it just points to his mental instability. It's somebody else's problem, it's not his.
It could also be maybe like a narcissistic trait of thinking that you're just good enough without actually doing the work. Marc was often heard complaining about women working non-traditional jobs. He essentially said that feminists were trying to get the best of both worlds by having the privileges that women had And I think he cited like maternity leave as one of those privileges amongst others. But they were also trying to get the privileges that men would get.
Does it state anywhere what his father did for work? Was he a stockbroker or something?
What I read, it just says that he's a businessman.
Yeah, I thought I saw somewhere where it stated that he was trading in mutual funds. And if his mother was a nurse, I wonder if his father's, the way that his father treated his mother is because he felt that she had a better job than him, being a professional woman. So I don't know how much that comes into play.
There was a lot of mention of his father sort of looking down at women and believing that they needed to be in traditional roles. And even though Mark said he hated his father, he still had that view of the role of women in society. He apparently really wanted a girlfriend, but he really wasn't good with women. When he was around them, he would boss them around and try to show off his superior knowledge. And he believed women's roles should be traditional. They should stay at home and they should tend to the household. Now in 2020, that sounds like something you shouldn't say as an opening line. In 1989, I don't think that would have worked either.
I recall in the late 70s, early 80s, the big thing was equal work for equal pay.
Yeah.
And in the field that I was working in at the time, the women were finally paid the same thing as the men were being paid. And, you know, 2020, it's still not a level playing ground.
Yeah, I think back to the 80s, I don't really remember much of it because I was pretty young, but the 90s and the early 2000s, how there was a lot of talk that feminists had done the work. It was done. Women and men were now equal. And I remember actually thinking that despite not getting equal treatment, it was kind of ingrained in us that we just shouldn't complain because we were equal and this is just how it was. But looking from the 2020 perspective, I can very well see that things were not equal at all. But at the time, we kept being told, yes, they are, you're fine, like stop complaining. That was essentially the 90s and the early 2000s. So I figure the 80s was probably even sort of a little bit more behind than what it was in the 90s.
Yeah, it was. And I recall working, like I was just starting out in my career at that time, but some of the men that were closer to retirement were absolutely appalled by the idea that the women were getting the same pay as them.
Didn't you work in an area where there was a lot of women?
Yes, there was. Yeah, probably 70% of the employees were women.
It's funny that men were getting paid more.
Yeah, and actually some of the men that were working there that had been there since the building was constructed, some of them had worked as bricklayers, and then there was this lovely job opening up that was year-round and inside and applied for the jobs and had no training and were still being paid more than the women.
That wasn't that long ago.
Well, not to me, it isn't.
In the grander scheme of things, it isn't. In 1989, Mark met with an admissions officer at the university, and he complained about how women were taking over the job market. So I think in his mind, his issues with keeping and getting a job had to do with women coming in and taking those jobs. Now I'm getting a little bit ahead of myself, but when the massacre was over, the evidence pointed to the fact that Mark had been planning it for several months. So in August of 1989, he had applied for a firearms permit. He would end up purchasing a Ruger Mini 14 semi-automatic rifle. And then between October and December, Mark was spotted several times at the Polytechnic School. Then in December, after always being punctual paying his rent, he failed to pay.
So just to go back for a second to this weapon he purchased.
Yeah.
In 1989 and in 2020, there's no reason for any private citizen to own a weapon like that. It's not a weapon that is appropriate for hunting and should be 100% illegal for a citizen to own. It's a weapon for military, for police officers and
right.
The like.
That's what I was about to say. Like, I know very little about weapons, but anytime I see the word automatic or semi-automatic, to me that means it's tactical. So there's no reason for you to have that in your house, on your person. On December 6th, 1989, Mark entered a classroom at the Polytechnic School. He separated the men and the women to either side of the classroom and then told the 50-ish or so men that were present that they should leave. He followed this with informing the women who were still present that he was fighting feminism and then promptly shot the 9 remaining women. He killed 6 of them and injured the rest. He then proceeded to move through the rest of the school looking for targets. In the end, he killed 14 women and injured 13 other people before finally taking his own life, according to the Canadian Encyclopedia.
I'm a little curious. In 1989, 50 men? Okay, dividing them. Okay, guys, get out of here. And they left, and he killed. Shot all these women. I wonder in 2020, under the same circumstances, if some of the men would stand up to him or just leave.
That's something that's discussed, and I did get into that a little bit later, but the media actually did criticize the men for not intervening in the attack and not stopping the shooting. But one of the female survivors actually spoke in their defense and said there's nothing they could have done. They more than likely would have gotten killed trying to stop him. And it was happening so quickly that most people didn't even realize what was going on. So at first, when he came in with the gun, everyone thought it was a joke. They didn't think it was a real weapon. So I think when he told the men to leave, they really weren't sure even what was happening, like if it was real, if it was a joke, what he was doing. So I can kind of imagine them leaving, scratching their heads, thinking, is this dangerous? Is this true? What's actually happening? And even one of the survivors says that she spoke to him and told him, like, I'm not a feminist, what are you doing? And then he just opened fire. So I don't think at the end of the day that the media's blaming the men for what had happened was helpful. They'd been traumatized enough. But I also don't think at any point do we know how we're going to react in those situations.
Yeah, it's easy for me to sit here in my rocking chair and to pass judgment. And being in the same situation as they were, I might have been the first one to dive out the window.
And that's the thing, you don't know. You can speculate and have an idea of what kind of a person you are, but until you're there, you don't know. And I remember listening to another podcast probably last year. I forget his name. The guy who went up in the States into the bell tower. And anyway, they were talking about a documentary that was playing, and it was about the story of this man and of the heroes that stepped up and actually saved a lot of people's lives. And two of them were actually these two, like, sort of nerdy kids that were there playing Dungeons and Dragons, essentially. And then one of them speaking in the documentary, and he says, I went out to like drag people that had been shot but weren't dead out of the line of fire, and there was no cover. And he said, like, I knew I could die, and I just made peace with it immediately and went out. And that really made me think, like, would I be the person looking at those people outside and saying, I wish I could do something, or would I actually go? And I honestly don't know the answer to that. I like to think I would be more heroic, but honestly, that's probably not, I don't think it's necessarily true. Again, you don't really know.
I think instinct kicks in too, and it depends. It's the fight or flee, and some of us will flee and some of us will fight.
Right, and some of us will freeze.
Right.
So 14 women were killed and 13 people were injured, and Mark ended up taking his own life. In a suicide letter that was found on his body and that was later leaked to the press, Mark blamed feminists for ruining his life. I'm not going to read the letter here because I don't want to say the words out loud that he wrote. They're words of hatred. And reading the letter made me extremely angry. It's online if you want to look at it, but I don't want to give his words that kind of power. But just to say that the letter did include the names of 19 women who he considered radical feminists and had intended to kill, but was unable to do because he had apparently started too late. Now, I don't know if that meant too late in life or too late in the day, but a lot of them were well-known figures, like public figures, like journalists and things like that, that he had on that list. So we talked a little bit about how the men were criticized by the media for not thwarting the attack, but the first responders to the scene were as well. It seems that the first officer on scene established a perimeter and waited for backup, which was protocol at the time. But as he waited, several women were killed inside the school. So this obviously drew a lot of criticism, and it led to changes on how first responders would deal with this type of attack. And later on, it was actually said that those changes saved lives in similar sorts of attacks that happened afterwards.
Well, again, it was one of the first mass shootings, and there was nothing to set a precedent.
If you don't have a playbook, right, you just follow what you typically do.
Right. And even in 2020, there's been situations like the Nova Scotia one, where there was no right and wrong way to react. They did the best they could underneath the circumstances, and you know, we all know the results of that, but.
And I think in situations like that, there's always mistakes that are made. Obviously, it never goes perfectly or exactly to plan. And it's tragic and it's unfortunate, but we have to look back and learn from those mistakes.
That's one of the reasons whenever there's a critical incident like that, there's always a debriefing or a post-mortem to see what went well and what went wrong and to tweak the plan so that the next time they're more prepared.
Yeah, exactly. And I think if nothing, this is something that we have to focus on what was learned and what can be done differently in the future to prevent these things from happening or unfolding the way that they did. In 2014, the Montreal Gazette interviewed survivors of the massacre. The survivors talk about the difficult aftermath of the shooting, but it seems that all of them found ways to move forward and find meaning in their lives. So it's almost like all of them that were speaking found something to sort of cling on to. So if it was gun control or helping children, or there was something in their life that they found that helped them move on from the tragedy. Not everyone was as lucky though, and they mention in the article that several survivors actually committed suicide after the massacre. And they actually cited in their suicide notes that the event was a reason behind them taking their lives. Which is just brings me to another point that society needs to be there for survivors. You do not walk away from situations like this and shake it off. Major trauma that's going to require intervention and years of help.
PTSD, survivor's guilt, on and on and on.
Yeah. The survivors that were interviewed in the Gazette also talk about how important it is to work on eliminating hatred. And they talk about how it was an attack against women, but at the root of it, hatred is what caused it. And that's what we have to work on, is eliminating hatred in the world. So I thought that was a really interesting point that they made there as well. In a 2019 article from CBC by Andrea Northcott, they mentioned that there's a memorial plaque in Montreal that described the 1989 massacre as, they called it a tragic event. And then in 2019, they changed the wording to describe the events as an anti-feminist attack. And a lot of people consider this very important to actually call it what it was. So not only was it a tragic event, but it was hatred directed towards women.
And I think it's just acknowledging that the attack was purposely against women.
Mm-hmm.
It was not a tragic event. It was a tragic event against women.
Following the massacre, there was a big movement towards more gun control in the country. So this massacre was a pivotal moment in gun control. Survivors and family members of survivors were key in passing Bill C-17 and C-68 for stricter gun control in Canada. If I understand correctly, some of the restrictions that had been put in place were actually eliminated by the Harper government.
They've been playing with that. There was a long gun registry they did away with. We all had to register the weapons that we had. They made two classes. There was restricted, non-restricted. Automatic weapons fell under the restricted class, which again, I feel is there's no need for a citizen to own. The non-restricted weapons, you need a firearm possession and acquisition license to buy new rifles, shotguns, and ammunition. But the sad thing with that is all it did was create sort of a black market, because if somebody does not have an acquisition license and needs to buy some ammunition, somebody's going to go and get it for him and sell it at a more expensive price.
Many reasons were given for possible motivations for Marc Le Pin's actions. Some suggested a personality disorder or maybe brain damage from the abuse he suffered as a child. Others spoke of changes in society that were taking place and creating a lot of frustration at the time. But at the end of the day, I don't think there is any motivation or explanation that'll ring true to explain his actions. What he did was unfathomable, and I don't think any motivation possibly explains it.
Yeah, there's for sure somebody, regardless of your struggles, you're not going to go out and murder people. Most of us won't. So there was some serious mental health issues, psychiatric problems with him that were not taken care of. And it just grew worse and worse until there was this explosion.
So instead of finishing up with a moment of kindness tonight, I'm going to end the episode by listing the names of the victims of the massacre. The bright young women who lost their lives at this massacre were Geneviève Bergeron, born 1968. She was a civil engineering student. Hélène Colgan, born 1966. She was a mechanical engineering student. Nathalie Croteau, born 1966. A mechanical engineering student. Barbara Dengo, born 1967, a mechanical engineering student. Anne-Marie Edward, born 1968, a chemical engineering student. Maud Havernick, born 1960, a materials engineering student. Marise Lagagnard, born 1964, she was a budget clerk at the school. Marise Leclerc, born 1966, a materials engineering student. Anne-Marie Lemay, born 1967, she was a mechanical engineering student. Sonia Pelletier, born 1961, a mechanical engineering student. Michel Richard, born 1968, materials engineering student. Annie Saint-Arnaud, born 1966, mechanical engineering student. Annie Turcotte, born 1969, materials engineering student. Barbara Klesnik Widajewicz, born 1958, and she was a nursing student. Thank you to everyone who's been listening. I hope you have a good night and stay safe out there.
Good night, everyone.